Sheen. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honors. And may it please the court. This case is about CP, a 74-year-old bedridden double amputee who cannot bathe, dress, or move on her own, who suffers from heart disease, chronic kidney disease, a compressed spinal cord, and gangrene, among other illnesses, who has spent the last 3 years of her life in the prison infirmary receiving 24-hour care. And since her compassionate release hearing, has endured a second amputation, a blood transfusion, a heart attack, and being placed on a ventilator. What's more, having served nearly the entirety of her 30-year parole ineligibility term as a model inmate, CP is now just 7 months away from parole eligibility. So the appellate division was correct to find that because CP meets the statutory criteria for compassionate release, and because nothing extraordinary warrants denial, CP should be released. And this court should affirm that decision. Additionally, it is imperative that this court clarify that extraordinary aggravating factors cannot be considered in isolation. And our trial courts must also consider and weigh any mitigating factors as part of the analysis. This concludes my opening statement. Now I'd like to address each of the extraordinary aggravating factors argued for by the state and the Attorney General, starting with factor one. First, I just want to clarify that the analysis is not whether the conduct was particularly heinous, cruel, or depraved. The analysis is whether the conduct was so particularly heinous, cruel, or depraved that it is extraordinary, whether it was exceptional and rare. And it was not here. To understand what is exceptional and rare, we have Eddie Oliver. And what this court found made that case extraordinary is the fact that the defendant executed a plot against the justice system itself. That is extraordinary. That is exceptional and rare. And we don't have anything like that here. What's also important to note is that this is not a case involving life without parole. The prosecutor agreed to a plea, and in turn, the trial court found that an appropriate punishment, considering all of the circumstances that the state and the Attorney General have discussed here today, that an appropriate punishment was 30 years of parole ineligibility, not life without parole, not the death penalty, to satisfy all of the punitive aspects of her sentence. This was from the perspective of a judge who was closest to the facts of this offense in time, and who was not considering all of the rehabilitative efforts that CP has overgone in the last 29 years.
So opposing counsel has listed off all of the reasons why they believe this is extraordinary, particularly given the number of victims, the fact that these incidents, the murders and the attempted murder occurred over the course of 4 years, the fact that there was financial gain as the incentive, and many other factors. Why don't any of those factors make this extraordinary?
Those factors don't take us to the level of extraordinary because it doesn't take it to the level of what we see in Eddie Oliver.
But are you suggesting that a case specifically with the facts from Eddie Oliver is the only case that is going to be found to be extraordinary?
No, not at all, Your Honor. But again, what the AM court made clear is that this discretion.
I'm sorry, you were done with your opening statement?
Yes, I was. Sorry. Oh, I apologize for not being
No, I think you had said that. I just wanted to make sure.
Yes.
That I wasn't encroaching on your 5 minutes.
No, not at all. But to get to your question, yes. Now, I'm not saying that Eddie Oliver is the only situation where we can find extraordinary.
Just out of, should we be using his name or initials?
We should be using his, I would say we should be using his initials, but that's, I believe, what the opinion uses. So that's why I was using the full name. But I for EO, the defendant in that case, Sorry, I just need a second to gather my thoughts. Again, not saying that that's the only situation where extraordinary factors can be found, but again, these are extraordinary aggravating factors. The court chose that word for a reason.
But the court chose four extraordinary factors, extraordinary aggravating factors, not just one. You're focusing only on factor three, an attack on the institutions of government or the administration of justice. The court could have chosen that as the only extraordinary factor if it wanted to, but instead it listed particularly heinous, cruel, or depraved conduct. So why is this case where the trial court judge, where the trial court judge had the opportunity to view all the testimony, CP herself testified, why was the trial court's decision that this was an example of depraved, heinous, or cruel conduct, not, how was that an abuse of discretion?
Because again, this is a very high standard, and there is not evidence in the record to support finding that very high standard. Again, I think something that's very important here is to recognize the fact that CP, despite being available, the prosecutor and the trial court did not impose the most extraordinary punishments that we have available.
It cannot be that only that extraordinary circumstances can only be found if the death penalty was imposed or if life without parole was imposed. There was absolutely nothing in the opinion in Oliver or State versus AM that even suggested that.
No, and that's not what I'm saying, Your Honor. What I'm trying to demonstrate is the fact that this fact supports the idea that this is not one of those extraordinary circumstances that warrant denial when CP otherwise meets all of the criteria of the CRA. Especially given the fact that CP received a less severe parole ineligibility period than AM, who was allowed to be released. Again,
counsel, what do we point to? In the opinion that will follow this case, what do we point to describe what is insufficient to reach an extraordinary aggravating factor as opposed to the EO case? What do we use? What do we rely on?
So the EO case provides, I think, a very clear example of what is extraordinary. It's this act that's, you know, almost equivalent to like what would be a terrorist attack. That is both exceptional and rare. Again, this isn't just about what is, you know, the worst possible thing. It's about what is exceptional and rare, what is unique about this case. And the facts of this case do not provide enough for a finding of extraordinary aggravating factors.
So the appellate division, in their opinion, stated that, you know, facts of premeditation, blunt force trauma, murder for monetary gain is often present in murder cases. But here we have that present in multiple murder cases. So it might be the case that that's not extraordinary if it happened one time, but here we have that happening multiple times over the course of many years. A lot of planning went into all of the murders and attempted murders that occurred here. So I'm not sure it's the case that this is a run-of-the-mill scenario where we often see defendants engaging in such activities.
So yes, Your Honor. But again, I think what's important to note is the standard is not that if you have a common offense and you meet the criteria, then you can be granted release. It's the absence of something that makes the case extraordinary.
But the trial court pointed out this that made the case extraordinary. I think seven separate things: soliciting others to carry out murders, procuring life insurance policies on each of the victims in advance, committing the crimes over more than 3 years, manipulating other people to execute her plans, including her own children and her daughter's boyfriend. Asking that boyfriend to beat one person to death with a crowbar and stab another person in the neck repeatedly, dumping two dead bodies, going to the hospital, pretending to be the victim's mother to get a DNR in place. How is the trial court's decision that all of that together is extraordinary, how is that an abuse of discretion?
Well, what I think is important to keep in mind when we're trying to decide what is extraordinary is the fact that, as the AM court acknowledged, most, if not many, of these compassionate release cases are going to involve very serious crimes with, you know, very unfortunate facts. And the CRA is in a lot of ways designed directly to address those people, to allow those people to be released, because it is people who are serving, you know, the longest sentences for the most serious crimes who are most likely to be old and sick and dying in prison.
But we don't see the trial court saying this, these were two murders and attempted murder, and those are really serious crimes. And that's what's going on. As Justice Wainwright was just pointing out, and Justice Pierre-Louis, there were factual findings that maybe in isolation might not be enough. But if you have seven different factual findings under an abuse of discretion standard, each of which appears to evince particularly heinous behavior, where's the abuse of discretion?
Again, the abuse of discretion is that, you know, the number of factors or the number of facts that the court points to does not necessarily make it extraordinary.
It's not just the number, though. The factors that the justices just went over with you go to the particulars of what occurred here. Mm-hmm. Why do those circumstances not take this out of the realm of the ordinary?
Because, like the appellate division found in its opinion, these are facts that are unfortunately not uncommon in these types of cases, in these serious homicide cases, facts of, you know, relating to the manner in which, you know, the act was carried out, facts related to the motive. These are first degree murder cases, and they're going to have very bad facts.
Right. But here we have first degree murder cases and first degree attempted murder case. That's all one individual who repeated the same pattern over and over again.
And again, there's nothing that bars multiple offenses or multiple victims from allowing someone to get compassionate release.
There's nothing that bars a trial court from using their discretion to determine that the facts of this case with the multiple victims bars compassionate release, correct?
No, but I think what's important so returning to Eddie Oliver, for example, that was a case that involved multiple victims. There was the one murder and then the attempted murders. However, that's not what the court focused on in finding that case to be extraordinary. What made that case extraordinary is this very specific and rare context that this conduct was carried out in which this was an attack on our criminal justice system, targeting these police officers, targeting the state court judge. And those are facts that we just don't have here, even, you know, considering the fact that there are multiple victims and multiple offenses.
If these were in the conjunctive and all four factors had to be found, I'd be with you on that, because there is no attack on the criminal justice system here, but they're not.
No.
It has to be one or more of these factors, and no one suggests that factor three is found here.
No, and I'm not suggesting that factor three needs to be found in order to deny release, but factor three is very helpful in showing to us what needs to rise to the level of extraordinary, what kind of facts can rise to that level. And if an attack on our criminal justice system, this orchestrated attack targeting police officers, targeting a judge, if that's what's extraordinary for factor three, then that's what we need something to be comparable to that when we're looking at these other factors.
And where is it an abuse of discretion where the trial court found this sort of rise and fall of premeditation between each victim and the ability to reset and select a new victim and deliberately go through the process of attempting to determine how they would meet their demise? I think isn't there something in the trial court's ability to find that this was extraordinary? And how is that an abuse of discretion?
No, it is an abuse of discretion, because again, that finding is just so high. It's again, The AM court makes clear that it can only be found in the most exceptional and rare circumstances.
So if a defendant is termed or classified as a serial killer, let's say, is that a case where it could be extraordinary circumstances, notwithstanding the fact that there was not an attack on the criminal justice system like in the EO case?
Certainly there could be a case where there are extraordinary circumstances involving a serial killer. However, again, the CRA and AM are very clear to not create any sort of categorical bar.
Exactly. And I mean, your argument, you're relying very heavily on the specific facts of the EO case.
Yes.
But at the same time, you know, making the argument that that none of those facts that were in EO are present here, and the attack on the criminal justice system isn't present here. So, you know, the compassionate release, that so there was an abuse of discretion by the trial court. So we have to look at each individual case, correct, to make a determination. And the trial court is vested with the ability to use their discretion in determining whether compassionate release is appropriate or not.
Absolutely, yes. But again, the trial court's findings here, these are findings that, you know, the facts of this case were, they found that they were heinous, cruel. This is a very high standard. Again, I'm going to sound like a broken record a little bit here, but the threshold for an extraordinary aggravating factor is so high. And I want to clarify that my comparisons to the EO case are not to say that you need to find those types of facts. It's that that is such a rare and such a unique case that is, when we look at what must be proven to find one of the other factors, that is our guide. That is what we can look to understand what is extraordinary. And that's not what we have here. Again, as the appellate division pointed out, the facts of this case are, while, you know, certainly tragic, when we're looking in the context of compassionate release, which again is going to involve cases with very serious facts, very serious crimes, this is not extraordinary.
Can you give me an example, if this case is not it, of what facts would constitute particularly heinous, cruel, or depraved conduct?
Yes, Your Honor. So, and again, I don't want to be advocating for any sort of categorical determination, but a situation like a mass shooter or a terrorist attack, perhaps a situation where there is a lot of, masochistic torture of the victims. Those could be situations where extraordinary aggravating factors could be found, where it could be so particularly heinous. Again, I think part of the reason why it can be difficult is because, again, it has to be something extraordinary. It has to be something beyond the norm of what we're going to be seeing in these very serious cases.
Where is the flaw in the trial judge's analysis here, where this is a pretty atypical situation in the unfortunate circumstance that we have, that there are many homicides throughout the state? This is particularly unique. This is not something that comes up very often. So in looking at these facts, what's wrong with the court's logic about where she went beyond her discretion and abused it?
Well, again, I would respectfully disagree, Your Honor. My position is that the facts of this case, multiple victims, blunt force trauma, having a motivation based on monetary gain, these are not extraordinary. And if that's what the trial court is relying on to find extraordinary aggravating factors, that's insufficient. And that's an abuse of discretion. Like,
there's more
here
than that. There is a, in the case of Ms. Carter, there was a really long-term effort to gain control over this 18-year-old, and a long-term family relationship that CP apparently set herself up as a parental figure in her life and agreed to have her stay and used her own young children to commit the murder, and the boyfriend of the daughter. And you have a moment here when Ms. Carter turns her back to have her hair done, very much what a parent might do. And what she then does is start the process in motion for her to be bludgeoned to death. So this is respectfully more than multiple victims. It's more than blunt force trauma. There is a really remarkable series of events here. Three times, that to me being the most compelling of the three, where she is using the trust of an individual to put that individual in a position where she's not only vulnerable, but is about to be killed.
So it sounds like, Your Honor, we're starting to get more into the vulnerability aspect.
Well, no, I know that's a second, a different factor, but it also goes to the first factor, because it is the method of committing the crime was to exploit the vulnerability of the individual. And that's true with respect to all three victims in this case.
So, Your Honor, I think what's important to note when we talk about this is that, unfortunately, you know, it's very common for people, you're more likely to be harmed by someone who you know than a stranger. And in the case of AM, for example, you know, this is a woman who killed her husband in their home. And, you know,
I'm not suggesting that any of these factors is met because there's a familial or close personal relationship. Obviously, that's very common, unfortunately, but very common. But I'm talking about the series of events that took place here in accordance with the factual findings of the judge, that where an adult in her 40s is setting herself up for to take on a parental role that would make the victim comfortable with her, knowing the relationships with her children. And at the very moment she turns her back, the order is given to kill her. And I would respectfully suggest that is not a run-of-the-mill crime.
And respectfully, Your Honor, I would say that, again, in the context of these sort of first-degree murders, which are going to involve this premeditation, they're going to involve relationships where there is a degree of trust and familiarity, it is not extraordinary.
And even with
following up on that point, is it your position these are routine factors in murder cases?
So
nothing more than routine factors.
Not necessarily that they're routine, but they don't need to be routine.
What are they? They're not extraordinary. How would you categorize them?
I would say that they are ordinary then.
Right. So just following up on some of what Justice Patterson was speaking about with regard to factor one, even in terms of Mr. Cooper, defendant was relentless in her in seeking to ensure that he was killed, that he died after the murder attempt, the stabbing was unsuccessful and he survived. As Justice Wehner after mentioned, she went to the hospital, brazenly impersonated his mother and asked that a do not resuscitate order be put in place to further, hopefully, I think, ensure that he would not survive. Again, that's one factor in a series of facts in this case that has already been discussed, but I'm not sure if that's something that is ordinary in executing a plan to kill one of three people over the course of 4 years.
And ultimately, Your Honor, I have to respectfully say that, again, pursuing this murder for monetary gain. And obviously, again, every case is going to have unique facts, but at the end of the day, this is CP's pursuing of this murder for monetary gain. That is not extraordinary. And again, I do think that it is important to consider the fact that the trial court that was closest to these events, that when considering all of these facts, found that 30 years was an appropriate amount of time to meet the amount of punishment that CP was deserving. And that is not an extraordinary punishment, but yet it does meet the crime because the crime is not extraordinary. And so I'm going to now move on to factor two briefly. Again, I think it's important.
Can you tell us a little bit? I'm sorry, you mentioned the state of CP's current health.
Yes.
Briefly. Can you give us some more information about that?
So I don't have a ton of details. Again, like is mentioned in the motion to lift the stay, in the intermediate time between granting the petition and now, CP had to go to the hospital because of a heart attack, and also the gangrene in her other leg had spread, and so that other leg needed to be amputated. And as a result of just how difficult that was, she needed a blood transfusion. There was talk about her being put on dialysis, but the doctors ultimately found that she was too weak to be able to handle being put on dialysis. And she was also put on a ventilator at that time.
Is she currently on a ventilator, or was that during a medical crisis?
I do not believe she is still on a ventilator, but I do not know exactly what her condition is today, unfortunately. And again, what these, you know, what the, all of these facts show is just how, you know, what in need CP is of getting compassionate release. But moving on quickly to address the second extraordinary aggravating factor, I just want to touch on a few things. Again, first and foremost, So again, there's, in terms of Ms. Carter, Ms. Carter being 18 years old and living on her own is not enough for an extraordinary aggravating factor. I think what's very important in the context of this extraordinary aggravating factor is that the trial court at sentencing did not even find that there was enough evidence to find the traditional sentencing aggravating factor about particular vulnerability of the victims. And I think that certainly demonstrates the fact that there's nothing extraordinary. If there was nothing enough for a traditional finding of an aggravating factor, there's nothing so extraordinary as to warrant the denial of CP's compassionate release here.
I think the state was arguing on this, not just that it was age, but that Ms. Carter had grown up with the victim. Their families were close friends, vacationed together. Ms. Carter was best friends with CP's daughter. And when Ms. Carter's family moved to Georgia and she initially moved with them, she then moved back to live with CP, thinking of CP as some sort of mother figure and it being a stand-in family because she had grown up as very close to this family. Do you disagree with those factual points?
I don't disagree with those factual points, but what I do disagree with is that would make Tara Carter an extraordinarily, a particularly vulnerable victim in such a way that is extraordinary. Again, if we look to AM, that is a case where these people were literally family. They were husband and wife, and this murder happened in their home. And this court did not find that made the husband so particularly vulnerable that it is extraordinary. Again, that is the finding here, that it has to be an extraordinary vulnerability, not just something that might have made her vulnerable. It has to be extraordinary. And this is not.
You mentioned in connection with factor two, the sentencing court's lack of a finding on that.
Yes.
We explored this a little bit with your adversary. Should it appears that what you're saying is that we should look back at the sentencing and look at the court's findings on a particular factor?
No, Your Honor, that's not what my position is.
Okay. I assume when the prosecution's reliance on the findings on factor one, I assume you would oppose that reliance. So why is it different for the defendant? Because you're pointing out to us, well, the court didn't even find, the court had all these facts, it was closer in time, the sentencing court didn't even find factor two. Why is that relevant?
So I have two parts to my answer to that question. So first, in terms of factor one, the reason why it's not relevant here, or the reason why it's not enough here, is because, again, the sentencing aggravating factor one there's a lesser threshold to make that finding than the finding here. So just because the sentencing court found that aggravating factor one existed does not mean that this comes anywhere close to being an extraordinary aggravating factor that is similar to factor one.
If the trial court had not found factor one, aggravating factor one in sentencing, would you rely on that?
Yes, and I don't think that that's contradictory, because what I think is important about that is if the trial court didn't even find that this lesser threshold was met, that this lesser threshold in this case of a particular vulnerability was met, I do think that that is important when then considering if the even higher threshold of an extraordinary aggravating factor was met.
Was this a point of contention at the sentencing proceeding? Did the state ask that vulnerable, that the aggravating factor relating to vulnerability be fined, and the court rejected it?
Unfortunately, I don't know that information, Your Honor, but I, nor do I think.
So then can we really rely on this threshold determination?
No, well, yes, we can. And I don't think that that is demonstrative, because, again, the trial court is free to find whatever factors are relevant in the record, whatever factors are apparent in the record. And so whether the state asked for it or not, it is not relevant, if, and especially when you consider the fact that, again, these are extraordinary aggravating factors. Certainly, if there is something so extraordinary about the vulnerability of these victims, that should be jumping out on the page. And that should be something that the trial court should find regardless of whether the state asked for it or not.
You think if this court were to send it back, and I'm not suggesting we would, to the trial court and say, can you do an assessment on the not extraordinary version?
Yes.
That it would come out differently from what the trial court did at the compassionate release hearing?
So if this was to go back to sentencing,
yeah,
and they were just reviewing the traditional...
This would have been overlooked, is my point, because we don't know that it was a point of contention.
Well, I think that would kind of suggest that this isn't extraordinary then. If it could be overlooked, then how could it be extraordinary?
So you think the trial court, if asked the question today, in light of the trial court's ruling at the compassionate release hearing, would say, oh, no, I'll call it the ordinary aggravating factor doesn't apply here, but I find the extraordinary one does. Does that make sense?
No, I'm not sure I quite understand your question, Your Honor.
The trial court found this factor, the extraordinary factor.
Yes, yes.
And you're suggesting to us that it either didn't, couldn't, or wouldn't find the one that required a lesser showing. Does that make sense?
Well, yes, they didn't find that here. And because the point is that the court in this case abused its discretion. That's why they found it here and why it wasn't found in the first instance. This was an abuse of discretion. That's why that those findings are contradictory.
Please go ahead. And I hate to point this out, we're beyond the half hour, and I know.
Okay, I apologize. Yes,
one more factor and the mitigating.
Yes, and I'll be brief about talking about factor three. So I just want to point out that, you know, the state is arguing that somehow the courts are in a position to measure grief and the amount of grief that victims' families might be experiencing. That is not, regardless of the testimony that the court heard, that is not something that the court is in the position to do, nor is it something that they should be doing. Grief, you know, again, grief is going to be an ordinary thing that victims' families experience. This has to be objectively reasonable. And the best way to determine, you know, whether the, another thing that I also want to point out is that this is about the detrimental effect of release on the victim's family, not just the fact that, you know, the effect of the offenses on the family or the loss on the offenses. It's the detrimental effect that the release would have on the victim's family and their recovery. And in this case, you have someone who at this point is 7 months away from being parole eligible. And when we're talking about the expectations that the victim's family have in terms of when the release of the victim is going to happen, it just doesn't make sense to say that if she was released now, it would be not just detrimentally affect them, but that it would be an extraordinary detrimental effect. And yet CP will be eligible for parole in just a few months.
Can I just go back to vulnerable victim for a second?
Yes, of course.
Does Eugene Cooper's autism make him a particularly vulnerable victim?
No, it does not, Your Honor, because while Mr. Cooper was autistic, we don't have anything in the record to suggest that we don't know where on the spectrum of autism he fell. We don't know how that impacted his ability to resist you know, being a victim in this case?
They said that he had someone making decisions for him, and that's why they believed that his autism impacted him in some way. Do you disagree with that as a factual matter?
No. So I agree that Mr. Cooper, it seems like, had some sort of financial, someone like managing his finances. That is not unusual. There's plenty of people with or without autism who have someone assisting them in making financial decisions. There's nothing more in the record to say that that made Mr. Cooper not just vulnerable, not just particularly vulnerable, but so particularly vulnerable that it was extraordinary. That's just not enough to make that finding.
He agreed to make his landlord the beneficiary of his life insurance policy, correct?
Yes.
And then another quick question about the husband.
Yes.
They take the position that he was ill. Mm. Does his age and his illness make him a particularly vulnerable victim?
No, it does not. When it comes to age, CP's husband was not, you know, he was not of a very advanced age, and he obviously was not incredibly young. He was, I believe, middle-aged. And that is just not extraordinary. When it comes to his illness, again, the record, we just don't have enough in the record to find that his illness made him extraordinarily, particularly vulnerable. We don't know what his illness was. We don't know what his capacity was. We don't know anything about that. And if we don't have that, then we can't make the finding that he was so particularly vulnerable that it was extraordinary. So no, that finding was also inappropriate here for her husband as well. And then just quickly to get back to the aggravating factor regarding victim testimony. Again, CP was, you know, at the time of the hearing, she was, I believe, about 2.5 years away from parole eligibility. She is now just a few months away from parole eligibility. When we talk about detrimental effect on the victim's family because of release, the fact that CP was so close from being parole eligible and being, as far as the law is concerned, able to get out of prison, it just doesn't make sense to find that it was not just a detrimental effect on the victim's family, but that would be extraordinary, especially when the only testimony we have from the victims has to do with their very understandable, and I don't challenge the credibility of it, their understandable grief over the loss of their loved one. And so the finding of extraordinary aggravating factor 4 was also inappropriate and an abuse of discretion. And then if I may just very quickly say that in addition to looking at extraordinary aggravating factors, it's just not accurate to just look at what is aggravating. We also have to look at what has come after the fact. And there's no other situation where our courts just consider what is aggravating. They have to also consider what is mitigating as well. And in this case, I won't go into it because it's laid out in my brief, we have a bounty of evidence about CP's extraordinary rehabilitative efforts, her almost 30 years without a single disciplinary infraction, the fact that she is so close to being parole eligible, the way that she has rebuilt relationships with her family, being a productive member of the prison working, all of that should also be considered in finding that CP should be released.
What is the statutory hook, if you will, to apply mitigating factors here? With respect to the aggravating factors, the AM court said there's this third factor. Victims have the right to be heard and meaning should be given to their testimony. And that served as the jumping off point for aggravating factors. What's the jumping off point in the statute for mitigating factors?
The fact that in AM, in crafting, you know, these extraordinary aggravating factors, the court takes guidance from the criminal code. And if that's how we're supposed to understand these extraordinary aggravating factors, everything in the criminal code about aggravating factors also requires this balance when we're also looking to mitigating factors. It just makes sense. It's the only way that we can understand how to approach these aggravating factors. There also has to be mitigating factors. And also the fact that the Compassionate Release Act, again, it is about the applicant. It is about where they are today, in large part, in terms of their condition. And that all has to be part of the calculus. If that is going to Again, given that the CRA favors release, given that it was designed to increase the number of people released from prison, many of those people who will have committed very serious crimes, that mitigating evidence has to be a part of the consideration.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Shalom.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court. I'm going to try and address six different points. I will do it briefly. Each of these six points applies with equal force, whether you think CP deserves compassionate release or not, which is to say, there's very limited jurisprudence right now on the Compassionate Release Act. It's essentially FED and the AM case, the two defendants in the AM case, the two petitioners. And as you develop that jurisprudence, there are certain traps I want you to avoid, or that the ACLU wants you to avoid. And so the first three of the points I want to make are about the extraordinary aggravating factors, and the last three are not. With respect to the extraordinary aggravating factor one, let me just say that what the state, but particularly the Attorney General, proposes is radical and is at total odds with AM. The idea that the word extraordinary in the AM opinion does no work because the sentencing aggravating factors themselves are already extraordinary would dramatically rework AM and totally write out of it the idea that these things should be exceptional and rare. Justice Patterson, I do think there is a difference between what the state is proposing, which is that a finding under 44.1 is sufficient for the aggravating factor, the extraordinary aggravating factor, with what Mr. Sheehan mentioned, which is that it is necessary.
Just to clarify, I'm not asking about sufficiency. I'm asking whether it's relevant, because whether the fact of a finding by the sentencing court is relevant in either direction.
I think the answer is yes, and particularly I think it's relevant because the absence of it is, I think, strong evidence, not fatal, which is to say, I'm not suggesting that it's necessary that the sentencing factor be found in order for the extraordinary aggravating factor to be found, but it would be the rarer case where the trial judge didn't find it, and then years later at the compassionate release hearing, they did. And so, Chief Justice Ravner, to your point about the disconnect on vulnerability, I don't doubt that if you remanded for sentencing to Judge Clark, she would find the ordinary aggravating factor of vulnerability. But the point was that 27 years earlier, a different trial judge did not make that finding. And that's, I think—
It would have been helpful to know if it was a point of contention. That's
absolutely
what I'm trying to get at.
I agree, but there is an obligation on both the prosecutor's part and the trial court's part to find those things. On vulnerability, moving on to my second point, Justice Fishali, you asked about autism. There were questions about youth. I was grateful to hear the Attorney General's concession that emerging adults are, in fact, more similar to children than to older adults. On all of those things, the answer
is— I missed that part of the argument.
I didn't, and I will go back to where the Chief Justice pointed it out. But there is this critical point here, which is those things might cause vulnerability, sickness, youth, and autism in this particular case. But you have to explain, you can't just say it. So there are two different places in the record where witnesses testified that Mr. Cooper had autism, but that's it. And so, right, there's the pre-sentence report is where we find the nature of the financial supervisor or whatever that was called, but we don't know how vulnerable he was. We know, Justice Wainer, after it's true that he let his landlord become the beneficiary of his life insurance, but we don't know anything about his life. And this is a place where there was a clear abuse of discretion by the trial court here. There was an inference that Mr. Cooper suffered. That's not the role here, to infer about suffering. Like we're dealing with competent evidence. That he suffered greatly. You'll see, it's in the briefs. There's this discussion where Judge Clark said, we know about the way in which the Carter family has suffered. And I infer, even though the prosecutor was unable to find Mr. Cooper, I infer that he has suffered greatly over the last 3 decades. That's just not an appropriate
of an attempted murder.
Right.
That's fine, but if we're trying to make a finding that is beyond the bare record, that inference is entitled to almost no evidential value. That is not right.
Even though we have in the evidence that he was stabbed on a street corner by someone that he knew. And
just to be clear, I'm not suggesting that the crime didn't cause him suffering. That is true from the nature of an attempted murder. But this is when we're talking about the suffering and the harm to the victims. So I'm transitioning, by the way, to my third point here. We're talking about from release. How is it going to impact their well-being and their recovery? There is no evidence with respect to Mr. Cooper about that. And that is not the sort of thing that can simply be inferred. Chief Justice Rabner, you asked with respect to the suffering of the victims, and I don't want to get into a quantification of suffering. They've all suffered terribly and more than they should. But you asked, how is this different from AM? Because all of the victims in AM opposed their own mother's release, the victim's family members. But there is a critical way in which this is different from AM, which is that AM was 8 years into a 40-year sentence. So her children had an expectation that she would be doing 32 more years, that compassionate release shortcutted. In this case, the expectation is that she would be doing 30 years. She has now done more than 29. And so that is also an abuse of discretion for the judge to not, in trying to figure out what an objective view of the harm of release would be, to think about how accelerated is compassionate release making this process. Moving on to my fourth point, away from the extraordinary aggravating factor.
Well, just one point. She's 8 months from eligibility for parole.
Correct. And the standard that she would be paroled under is if the probability that she's going to commit another crime. And so knowing what Judge Clark's finding was, that she could not commit another crime, it is possible, I grant you that, Justice Patterson, that the parole board would violate the law and keep CP in prison. But if they follow the law, she will be released on her first eligibility date.
AM was, of course, found to be eligible for compassionate release.
Yes.
That's why I was asking, what's the material difference in that case and this?
Right. And I'm saying there is not more suffering that the families would suffer in CP than in AM. There is, in fact, less suffering because of the temporal distance between.
What about the fact that we have two families that we know who have people testify, and we have presumably Mr. Cooper who remains alive, and any family members that may be in his life as well. We have three distinct groups here.
Right, one group supported CP's release. That's her first victim's family, which is also her family.
Her children.
Yes. Right. So different, though, than in AM. One group, the Carter family, opposed her release. We've talked about them. And the third group, and this is the point I was trying to make, I don't think we can make inferences about Mr. Cooper's family because we have no testimony. I mean, the reason we have evidentiary hearings is to weigh testimony, not to say what we think might have been or should be or it's likely to be. Okay. Maybe I'll do this slightly out of order. Let me just pick up on the mitigating factor piece. Two points to make on that. The first is it's not every mitigating factor. It doesn't mean going into 44.1b and saying these are the factors. It's the things that have happened since. And so Mr. Sheehan talked about what those are. The fact that in 29 years, not one disciplinary infraction. That is, frankly, extraordinary and rare and worth consideration. But Chief Justice Rabner, let me try and respond to your question about what is the hook? Why would we be considering mitigation? As I took the AM opinion and this divisive aggravating factors, the court was asked in AM to consider whether or not judges had this residual discretion once they had made the threshold determinations. And the court said, Yes, but we want to guide that discretion, and particularly we want to ensure that it's rarely utilized because that's consistent with the legislature's goal of expanding compassionate release. And so the court said, essentially, we want to try and narrow this to the worst cases, and that's what extreme aggravating factors are. But in no other instance do we identify the worst cases just by looking at how much bad stuff there is. We weigh the bad stuff against the stuff that favors the defendant. That's true in sentencing. That was true in capital sentencing. That was true in proportionality review. It just doesn't make sense to look at one side of the ledger, even if they're really heavy items weighing on that scale, if they're kind of pulled down on the other side of the scale. And so I think that's what the hook is.
The trial judge considered evidence favorable to CP.
No. In fact, Judge Clark explicitly said some things that she would not consider were the proximity of the parole date and the disciplinary record. I cite to it in my brief. I don't have the citations available right now, but she explicitly said she was not going to consider the proximity to parole. And I think that is a mitigating factor that weighs heavily.
But proximity to parole, that's not a traditional mitigating factor. That has nothing to do with anything.
And I'm not suggesting that what we're weighing are traditional mitigating factors. These are essentially extraordinary mitigating factors, things that have happened since release, since sentencing, that weigh in favor of compassionate release. And so what I'm suggesting to you is that CP stands in a better position because it had been 27 years since her sentencing than had it been 27 months since her sentencing, or 8 years, or anything in between. And I think the fact that Judge Clark said categorically, I won't consider that, is a failure to try and identify the subset of cases that are the most serious, the most aggravated. I think the way you identify aggravation is not just by adding, but by adding and weighing. And I think that is consistent with so many other parts of our criminal code. On the question of public safety, the issue is waived. There's a citation, the prosecutor at least cites to Watson, where the court says, essentially, if you prevail on the big issue, you don't have to file a protective appeal on the smaller issues on which you didn't win. But then the next sentence in Watson, which is not cited, says, but if you don't advance those issues on appeal, they're waived. That's what happened here. If you accept the state's invitation, and the attorney general incidentally briefs the public safety piece without discussing waiver, which is a curious choice. But if we do that, what you're turning this court into is a court of first review rather than a court of last review, where you're just depriving the appellate division of the ability to look at that issue. And I think that's wrong.
I'm sorry to interrupt. They say it's a matter of sufficient public concern. Public safety.
The attorney general.
And the state.
The state confronts this. The attorney general in their brief doesn't mention the fact that it's not argued at the appellate division. Today they did. And so look, if you want to get to the merits on the public safety, I think the problem is the state, neither of my adversaries have been able to answer the question of how does this not become, under FED or their view of FED, a categorical bar on those who solicit murder. If her physical ability to speak in cogent sentences makes her physically capable of soliciting murder, it would really make it a categorical bar, the exact categorical bar that the court in AM said was prohibited. But I think Justice Patterson really did make an appropriate point on this wasn't, the allegation wasn't that CP picked up the phone book, called someone and said, please kill someone. This was a more sophisticated and a longer term plan. And so what Judge Clark's finding was that she couldn't repeat that she lacked the physical ability to repeat that. And I think that's a finding that is entitled to deference, is both correct and entitled to deference. Okay, last point. And I feel a little bit like a broken record on this, but I'm back again on this question of initials. And so Justice Patterson, you just asked whether we should be referring to Eddie Oliver as EO. His name is in the published opinion, and so we shouldn't be referring to him as AO. But this is a bigger than compassionate, it applies to compassionate release. It's bigger than compassionate release.
What more should we do, having already asked the legislature twice?
Right, so you've asked them twice, and you maybe ask a third time, but there's a bigger point, which is if you want to protect There's a choice to be made, and you've made the choice in each case on what to do. So with FED, you used initials. With AM, you used initials. With Mr. Oliver, you used his name, Mr. Camus, Mr. Oliver. And with CP, you used initials. But you're using their real initials. So you're disserving both sides of the balance. You're making it a little harder for people to figure out who we're talking about, which harms the interest in transparency. But not hard at all. It takes 30 seconds to go onto the Department of Corrections website and figure out who each of those defendants are. So it's privacy theater. If you want to do real privacy, make them AA, AB, AC, make up initials. That's how pseudonyms can work. And to be clear, this is a broader critique of the judiciary's use of pseudonyms. You do it wrong everywhere. So when we're dealing with cases where there are sex assaults and the familial sex assaults, so you're trying to protect the victim's identity by not listing the defendant's name, you use the initials and people can go onto the DOC website and figure it out in a minute. My brief really runs through each of these things, whether it's Miranda issues or whatever. There are better ways to do it. It can be John Doe or Jane Doe. And I have tremendous respect for the judiciary. So my critique here is born of love, but I think you identified in both FED and AM important competing interests in privacy and in transparency. And right now they're both being disserved by the use of real initials.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Lee.
Thank you, Your Honors, and may it please the court. This case does not involve any exceptional and rare circumstance that constitutes the exceptional aggravating factor that this court talks about in AM. There is no logical or practical reason to keep CP incarcerated and within the Department of Corrections system, because CP is the exact type of persons that the legislature intended to be released, thereby reducing the strain on the limited budget of the Department of Corrections and allowing it to use those funds towards its other goals, such as rehabilitation and reintegration. Now, this court is already familiar with the litany of health issues that CP was dealing with when she first petitioned the trial court for compassionate release. It has been nearly 3 years since then, and her condition has only worsened, keeping in mind that she has required intensive health care and treatment during this period of time. So what then is the logical reason in denying CP's release when she has served nearly 30 years of her sentence with a spotless record? Looking to the statutory purpose of incarceration, it cannot be to promote public safety when her around-the-clock care requirement and the prior finding of that shows that she is in no way a threat to society. It also cannot be to promote restitution to the victims either, keeping in mind the imminent eligibility for parole that is very quickly coming up. And it certainly should not be the role of the Department of Corrections to continue operating as this high security nursing home and healthcare facility that it has been, because the reality of the situation is that even if CP is granted release, her current condition ultimately means that she will live the remainder of her life as a prisoner of her own body. And so there is no practical reason in keeping CP incarcerated either, because CP, who is now 74 years old, is in a body that is biologically older than that calendar age due to the effects of age acceleration induced by incarceration. She requires the type of healthcare that is about as extensive and constant as is possible. Our state budget documents show that it costs up to $2 million per year per person solely for any offsite healthcare visits that would be required. And this does not factor in transportation costs.
$2 million a year per person
per year that requires any offsite medical visits that may be required.
$2 million for any offsite medical visit?
Correct. Correct. This was a number that was...
So is that not an aggregated number of multiple inmates requiring health care that adds up to 2 million? I just find it hard to say that 2 million per person per year.
No, that number in my contained in the brief was a number that was given by a Department of Corrections spokesperson that stated that that was a number that was.
I'm not saying that the number 2 million is incorrect, but mm-hmm. 2 million per person per year for offsite medical visits?
Correct. It is a shocking amount, I know.
Those are some expensive medical visits.
Yes. And one part, it has to do with the requirement for around the clock security, the overtime that comes along with that. And that number also does not include the actual cost of medication itself. And so my point being that CP can and will actually receive more adequate health care outside of the DOC, which simultaneously fulfills, you know, this aspect of receiving compassion as part of, you know, the aptly named Compassionate Release Act. And so the ACDL, you know, fully endorses the statements and arguments made by my colleagues today, and that there simply is no extraordinary aggravating factor in this case that is so exceptional and so rare. And there certainly is no factor that should override the legislature's goal in reducing the immense strain on taxpayer dollars, allowing it to be better utilized to accomplish those other goals of the DOC.
Thank you, Counselor.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Carrigan, brief rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. I would briefly address and rebuttal 2 points. First, the defendant's argument about mitigating factors and about the extraordinary aggravating factors. And second, I'll close briefly by addressing the public safety concerns again. So first, Your Honor, defendants argued that the case that does not meet compassionate release should be, or the case that does meet compassionate release should be exceptional and rare, that the act is intended to release inmates. However, the act is intended to release inmates, not just because they're inmates, but because they satisfy the criteria of the act. CP does not satisfy the criteria of the act. Defendant argues that, the factors should be considered to determine court needs to determine what is extraordinary. The court has determined what is extraordinary when it laid out those factors in the State versus AM case. The court found explicitly in AM that inmates who are not disqualified under the medical and public safety criteria should be granted compassionate release unless one or more extraordinary aggravating factors exists. The court said one or more, not all four of the extraordinary aggravating factors. CP is not precluded from having her petition denied simply because she did not commit an offense against the institutions of government. As indicated, each factor individually shows what is extraordinary. In AM and EO, this court granted compassionate release to one inmate and denied it to another. I point out the case that the defendant AM, to whom compassionate release was granted, is in an extremely different circumstance than is this defendant. In AM, there was one victim. Here, there are three. In AM, the victim was the defendant's husband. Here, the victims are the defendant's husband, autistic tenant, and the defendant's daughter's best friend. In AM, it is a more or less a crime of passion. And self-defense. The victim in AM, the defendant's husband, was not vulnerable. He was her husband. They were engaged in a dispute, and AM shot him as he was approaching her aggressively, according to AM. There is no such self-defense, no such passion, our passion provocation argument in CP's case. In CP's case, her crimes were planned out over the course of many months. Well, she solicited assistance from her accomplice, procured insurance, fraudulent insurance policies, et cetera. CP's case involves a financial motive, desecration of bodies, hindering after the fact, vulnerable victims, and imbalance of power. CP's case simply cannot be equated to AM's case. Defendant and amicus argue at some length about the sentence and the fact that they argue CP is likely to be granted parole. We're not here to decide whether CP is likely to be granted parole, whether she will be granted parole. In fact, in AM, this court specified that the severity of the sentence is not a consideration when determining compassionate release. There's been some discussion about how compassionate release can be granted to inmates convicted of any crime, including murder. It can also be granted to inmates convicted of less serious crimes. And that's why the severity of the sentence is not important. If this were an inmate who were convicted of burglary and sentenced to 5 years and likely to be paroled soon, we would still apply the Compassionate Release Act. We wouldn't simply release the inmate because the parole eligibility date is nearing.
Mr. Kerrigan, yes. Should the court, as a general matter, consider whether guidance as to mitigating factors should be part of the equation? If memory serves, when AM and EO were argued to the case, argued to the court, the parties extensively briefed aggravating factors. But now is the first time that we're hearing a request with respect to mitigating factors. Should the court go down that road and entertain and provide guidance in that area as well?
Not in this case, Your Honor, because no mitigating factors that should have been considered by the trial court were not considered by the trial court. And that's where I disagree with the argument posed by amicus, the ACLU, when the statement was made that Judge Clark did not consider CP's disciplinary record or lack thereof in prison.
So are you saying the mitigating factors that are being discussed shouldn't work to the advantage of CP? I was asking a slightly different question. Should the court provide guidance as to mitigating factors in addition to the guidance that already exists for extraordinary aggravating ones?
I suppose what I'm saying, Judge, is that in this case, Judge Clark did explicitly consider the limited mitigating evidence that was presented to her, that being the lack of a disciplinary record in prison and the programs that defendant completed in prison. And I'm looking at page 56 of the ruling where Judge Clark states, I further note that while in prison, she has had no infractions. Testimony from prison doctors indicated she was compliant with prison rules, gets along well with other inmates. Likewise, she has produced multiple certificates marked as D2 in evidence, and the judge goes through the different programs that were completed.
Counsel, is the judge's reliance on those factors appropriate?
Yes, in this case, it was appropriate for the judge to consider that mitigating evidence that was presented in relation to the public safety factors. To answer your honor,
you're saying that it was relevant to public safety, but not as to there was not set up as a counterpoint to the four extraordinary aggravating factors. Or to infraction-free history in the corrections system was relevant to the public safety factor.
That was how Judge Clark considered it. Yes, and at that point, Judge Clark was acting on the guidance issued by this court in AM. And she specified, Judge Clark specified in her ruling that AM was handed down by this court while her case with this defendant was pending and that she required further briefing. She addressed specifically the findings of AM. So in that case, what Judge Clark was asked to consider was is the medical criteria satisfied, which she found that it was? Is the public safety criteria satisfied? And are there any extraordinary aggravating factors? Having found that three existed, Judge Clark properly exercised her discretion to deny that petition. Sorry, Your Honor, have I answered your question?
You did.
At this point, Judge, I'm going to move on to my second point, unless there's any other follow-up, addressing the public safety issue. And I understand, Judge, that there is an argument that that I should have filed a cross appeal to address the public safety issue in front of the appellate division. And I did not do that. And if I should have done that, I apologize.
I don't know that that's necessarily the argument. Don't be too hard on yourself.
Thank you.
it's not that you needed to file a cross petition. It's whether the argument was advanced at all in front of the appellate division.
Yes. Yes, Judge. And I concede that it was not advanced in front of the appellate division. But that being said, I do not concede that it is not an issue that is so important that it should be ignored by this court and that this defendant should be released, despite the fact that we may or may not believe she poses a threat to public safety. This issue, like I said, there was no cross appeal filed. It was not brought up in front of the appellate division. That being said, we do have a complete record of it before the trial court, because it was brought up by the state and argued at the trial court. The record was developed, and this court has a full record upon which to base its decision as to whether there's a public safety risk. That record includes evidence that this defendant manipulated multiple people to commit crimes on her behalf. Specifically, two of the people she manipulated were her children. Her son, who I identified as AP, was convicted of hindering for lying about the defendant's whereabouts at the time of the murder. And perhaps more significantly, her daughter WP was convicted and sentenced to a significant sentence in excess of 20 years for participating in the murder of Ms. Carter. I would note that this is an ability, the ability to influence people, to convince people, to manipulate people into committing crimes for you, is an ability possessed by few. It is an ability that is exercised by even fewer. Here we have a person who has that ability, who has shown the willingness to use it and the intent to use it. These are purposeful crimes. We're not talking about recklessness. We're not talking about knowing. We're talking about her purposely soliciting people to engage in murderous activities on her behalf. In two instances, we're talking about her doing it with her children. And she's asking this court to release her to the custody of one of her children, not WP, but IE, who is also reportedly, according to the pre-sentence report, involved in the dumping of her father's body. Pre-sentence report indicates that Mr. Cooper told police that he helped defendant dump her husband's body along the street in Patterson near the railroad tracks, that all the children helped other than the one identified as AP. So, Your Honor, we have someone here who has shown the ability to manipulate people, the willingness to do so, the intent to do so. She did it within months of the very last time she was free, and she did it to her own children. She's now being asked to be released to the custody of her children at a time when, although her health is failing, she can still speak, she can still express herself, she can still manipulate people, per what we know.
I appreciate why you've gone to the merits. Can you give us a sentence or two as to why the issue isn't waived?
Yes. Your Honor, the issue isn't waived. For one thing, because the record is fully developed at the trial court, and this court can review that record. The issue is not waived because it is an issue of significant public importance. The court is able to review it, given the record created at the trial court, and the court should take this opportunity to review it, given the importance of the issue. That's all I have. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you to all counsel for the very fine arguments. We will take the matter under advisement.